You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, July 26th. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow. The New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Matt Taibbi on the LIBOR hearings, on the Fed, on the general corruption of our financial markets. The fan of the octopus, Guy Lawson's book. We had Guy on this program a week ago. We will chit-chat, tete-a-tete about that. Also on the program today, turns out, who knew? Medicaid saves the lives of people. Also, the horrible drought across the country. Frankly, many places in the world. About to see the effects soon. The extreme heat. The volatile weather. Just part of the new normal. And it will get worse. The more new and worse normal. And also raising issues as to why we are not investing in our infrastructure in this country when it would be so fiscally prudent to do so. You get the NSA revelation that they, broke that Constitution thing. That NYPD audio, 9/11 audio tape that we wanted to play yesterday. And poor Mitt Romney. For an Anglo-Saxon, he sure can step at it in Anglo-Saxon territory. But first, ladies and gentlemen, we had mentioned, I don't know if it was yesterday or the day before, I can't remember. I no longer have a concept of time anymore. We had previewed the vote that was going to take place in the Senate, where the Democrats were attempting to preemptively extend tax cuts for the first $250,000 a couple may earn, and allow for the other Bush tax cuts to expire come 2013 when they are set to sunset as per the first initial provisions in the Bush tax cuts and then the extension of the Bush tax cuts. We anticipated that the Republicans would filibuster the measure. However, I think it was yesterday morning, we had announced that Mitch McConnell, Catherine Harris's favorite beanbag, would filibuster, and then he apparently said we're going to allow for a vote. There were two votes taken yesterday. The first was a Senate Republican bill to extend all of the Bush tax cuts for 1 year. The measure was defeated 45-54. Mark Pryor, Democrat from Arkansas, voted with the Republicans. Senators Scott Brown, Scott, I'm worried about Elizabeth Warren Brown, apparently, from Massachusetts, voted against it. Susan Collins, Republican from Maine, also voted against it with the Democrats. The Democrats then brought up their bill, which was, again, to extend the Bush tax cuts only to the first $250,000 that is earned by a couple. If you don't earn $250,000, you still have those tax cuts. That's an important distinction to make because apparently even the Washington Post can't seem to report it properly. It's not for people who make over anything less than $250,000. It's for everybody on their first $250,000. That's the way marginal tax rates work. And that bill passed 51-48. Now, there's a now the House will take up their own bill. They are sure to extend the Bush tax cuts. They will attempt to refute the validity of that vote because any type of taxing bills must originate in the House. However, it is possible they won't. It's possible it could go to conference and then it would be hammered out in conference. Highly unlikely. So you have to ask yourself at this point, why in the world would Mitch McConnell want to take this vote, which shows just how determined Republicans are in providing tax cuts for people who make over $250,000, not just for people who make over $250,000, but for all the money they make over that. Tax cuts on the millions of dollars that people make above $250,000. And the only answer you can come up with is that they actually think this is helpful to them. Despite the fact that we see all the polling that says the majority of Americans disagree with that tax policy, it's because they think it's more valuable for them to go back to their moneyed constituencies and say, look, we're gonna come hell or high water, we are in your corner. And so fascinating that the only time we actually get a true majority vote, both sides think that they have won. Now, of course, it's all political posturing, but that's what happens in politics. People posture in a political manner. Now, I want to remind you, though, that because the extension of these tax cuts apply to the first $250,000, whether you make $25 million a year or whether you make $25,000 a year. And for people, for a family of four that makes $25,000 a year, you are you also will get earned income tax credits, et cetera, et cetera. But the Tax Policy Center estimates that the Senate Democrats bill, as written, would still cut taxes on the top 1%. Or retain the tax cuts for the top 1%. For anybody, let's say, for instance, you're making $1 million, you'd still save $15,000 on your tax bill. The Republican bill would cut taxes on someone who's making $1 million by more than $75,000. So we're still allowing people, I mean, frankly, I think all of them, all right, fine. Extend the tax cuts for the first $250,000 for a year if you want, but we've got to just simply go back to, well, not just Clinton tax marginal tax rates, but Reagan or Eisenhower or Kennedy or just about anybody else that has been president for certainly as long as anybody I know has been alive. Although my grandmother is 100. And so I guess back in 1912, you could get away without paying your taxes, particularly if you were a robber baron. So interesting to see how that'll play out as the parties sort of position themselves for the election. Later in the program, the better half will talk about the panel that I moderated last night with Chris Hedges and Rob Johnson, and Patrick Markey and Taylor Joe Eisenberg down at the Culture Project. It was very interesting and great to see some majority reporters out there. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Matt Taibbi, if all goes well. We'll be right back. Right, folks, we are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report, and it is a pleasure, as always, to welcome back to the program Matt Taibbi of Rolling Stone magazine. Welcome, Matt.
How's it going, Sam?
It's going well. How are you doing?
Good, good. Yeah, excellent.
I didn't
happy to be back on your show.
I didn't wake you, did I?
No, almost.
All right,
yeah,
I understand. But, I know how you guys, Rolling Stone magazine, we know what happens over there.
Right, right.
We all
right,
get there.
Yeah.
We all, all right. So there's a couple of things I wanted to talk to you about. Let's start with this audit the Fed bill that passed the House. We both know that it's not going to go anywhere. The Senate's not going to pass it. But let's just for a moment, and we should say that it passed with almost entirely Republican support. I think there was one Republican who joined about half of the Democratic caucus in voting against it. Let's just talk about the value of this. There was a one-time Fed audit in the past, yes?
Yeah, right, exactly. Inspired by Ron Paul and Bernie Sanders.
And I think Alan Grayson in the House, too, was
right,
a big
Grayson,
part of
yeah.
that. And that was
yep.
part of Dodd-Frank. It was a one-time audit, which was, as far as I can tell, not problematic, not earth-shattering in terms of, you know, destabilizing our monetary system. And it was helpful to get a sense of what they did during the bailouts.
Yeah, the amazing thing about that thing was that even though there were some pretty incredible revelations out of that audit, it proved not to be all that harmful to the Fed because the media basically didn't pay any attention to it. So even though there were some incredible things, like you know the fact that the Fed had given out $16 trillion in emergency lending since 2008 and had been giving you know, loans to everybody from banks in the Middle East to the, you know, the wives of CEOs of big Wall Street banks. It didn't really leave a stain on the Fed because nobody really covered it.
Get that last one. I had not even heard until reading about, you know, sort of stories around this, this bill. What, tell us that. I had never heard this. The Fed gave loans to wives of owners of banks to go out and shop?
Yeah. well, not to go out and shop, But they were. It was. I actually wrote the story, and I can't even remember. It was the wives of a couple of Morgan Stanley executives, and what they had a hedge fund, who they qualified for a program called TALF. Interestingly, in Washington, when this story started circulating, they were nicknamed the TALF MILFs. But these two women got a $220 million loan from the Fed, essentially to act as middlemen for consumer lending. A lot of this is complicated, but what the Fed really was doing with a lot of these bailout programs is it was giving free money to banks and asking them to stimulate the economy by using that money to, provide auto loans or student loans. So people like this would get the money at zero, and then they'd lend it out to us for a car loan at, six or whatever, and so they'd make free money. And so some of the people who are on this list were extraordinary, not just these housewives, but if you might remember the name Kenneth Dahlberg. Does that name ring a bell to you at all? He was the guy who whose check ended up in the account of the Watergate burglars. He was the character in All the President's Men. He got a loan through this program. So almost everybody got there were so many people who got loans. But again, it didn't really make a dent in the Fed after all this came out.
And of course the theory was, and this has been sort of, I mean, this is almost sort of the paradigm that we've seen since the beginning of this crisis. Give free money to the banks so that they can loan it out and make money off it. And the problem with that is that when you have an economy that is in the ditch, essentially, there's people don't want to go out and take out loans to buy crap. Because they're worried about the debt that they're already carrying, and they're afraid that they're not going to be able to pay it off later. So what happens is the banks turn around and they say, well, we can try and loan people for cars or for houses or whatnot, but if the demand's not there, and why take the risk when we can just turn around with this free money, buy treasury bills, essentially,
right,
and know that the treasury is going to pay it off, and then we make our, 3% at the time or whatever it was.
That's one thing. Or they massively leverage up the money, 100 or 200 times, and they make gigantic leveraged bets on derivatives, which can lead to these catastrophic losses, and I think that's what you saw with the JP Morgan Chase thing. So either outcome is bad. It's not what's intended. I mean, what's intended is that they're supposed to stimulate the economy, and you get sort of just the opposite of that.
And so, that's the thing that people, I think, we need to make clear for people is that the agenda theoretically was not to just enrichen the banks. It was, we're going to help the economy, and the banks will, we are going to be incentivized in some way to help the economy, rather than, for instance, in the original TARP, just going and paying money loaning money at 0% interest. And if you're going to do it for the banks, why not do it for homeowners? And they pay off the banks that way and make sure that money goes to the use that ostensibly, the Fed wants it to go towards, deleveraging people in some way.
The Wall Street's answer to that would be, well, the government could never administer all these loans. They need to contract out with us to find all these people to lend to, so we should get a cut. And that does make some kind of sense, but the problem is we didn't impose any conditions at all when we did these programs. We didn't say, here's a bunch of money for student loans, but you can only charge X. We gave the money for nothing, and they charge, full market rates. And so that's the problem.
I think I haven't read the book yet, but I think there's a lot of, in Borofsky's book, a lot of that comes out where there seems to be, I don't know if some type of naivete or just sort of like, you know, we're just not in the, we don't want to in any way impinge upon bankers, you know, rights, you know, freedoms with our money,
right.
In some
right.
way,
right.
Because that would be, you know, anti-American,
exactly.
to infringe exactly. upon their, I mean, what do you think, like, you know, one of the things that I've seen, and let me ask you this, in terms of helping the economy,
mm-hmm.
People disagree as to whether or not the Fed actually has any more ability to help the economy. The arguments that they do have the ability center around doing, as far as I can tell, two big things. One is setting a higher inflation target. And two is, instead of, you know, you're giving these, you're talking about opening up the discount window again for banks. Why not open it up for cities and states? Who need to borrow money and need to, you know, and you, when you lend that money to the states, you know they're going to spend it on stuff that's going to stimulate the economy in some fashion, because they don't have the ability to go in and buy derivatives or
right, yeah,
they're not
exactly.
going to. It's just the business that they're in. Give me your sense of that. What's your take on what the Fed theoretically could do, if you think they could do anything at this point?
Well, some of this is a little bit above my pay grade. I mean, I think I was actually at a dinner last night with a whole bunch of Wall Street economists who were kind of heatedly discussing this very topic of what is the Fed's role. And, you know, the general consensus is that we're in a situation right now where there's really only two, where there's so much debt that is being held by all the major industrialized countries, that there is really only two outcomes that could possibly solve the debt problem. One is default, and the other one is inflation. And in the meantime, the way that we're sort of moving the problem into the future and not having to deal with it right now is by sort of endlessly creating money through central banking mechanisms like the Fed, and just sort of pumping it into the financial bloodstream to continually stave off the debt problem. And, you know, I think there's a debate to be had over whether that's appropriate or, I mean, again, I think this is a little bit above my pay grade. You know, what happens if the Fed suddenly stops you know, pumping money into the economy and we all have a default? Is that a good outcome? But is it a good outcome for them to continue to do this as well? Because that's eventually going to lead to this inflationary mess. So I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question. But clearly, the one thing that is obvious is that it's all being held together by cheap money from the Fed and from central banks.
Now, when they
because
say
without that,
when you say debt in this context, you're talking about private debt.
Private and public debt. I mean, both things. I mean, if you look at especially private debt. I mean, if you look at the biggest banks in America, the depository, the big to fail banks, they probably have just the American ones. They probably have $350 or $400 trillion of risk wrapped up in derivatives, and that's backed up by you know, only about $7 or $8 trillion in deposits. So the real backing for all of that is the central bank. I mean, it's the idea implicitly that if any of those banks collapses, that they'll be bailed out by the Fed is sort of what keeps everybody from panicking and running for the exits. I guess this is from what my understanding of the issue. But clearly, you know, we had quantitative easing one, we had quantitative easing two. Everybody expects that there's going to be another round of QE coming maybe this fall or this winter, and that is what's patching the hole and preventing the debt problem from becoming overwhelming.
And the thing that strikes me is just sort of this notion that somehow the Fed will just stop. You know, I mean, it's like the as if it's sort of the Fed doesn't is sort of, I guess, blind to certain things that are happening in the economy. I mean, I think, I don't know, I certainly believe that we could do for some inflation, and there's no reason I can see why the Fed wouldn't loan to cities and states at this point, because, you know, what if you're going to do it to the banks, why not?
Right. Yeah. No. I completely agree. If we're gonna do this, if we're gonna just endlessly create money and put it out into the economy, I don't see any reason why we have to have Wall Street as a middleman taking the bulk of it as a cut and turning it into profit, which is the most wasteful way to deal with that money. I mean, that doesn't make any sense at all. I mean, just look at the way we handle our own sovereign debt. You know, we lend money to banks at zero, and then they go turn around and buy T-bills at 3% or whatever, and we're just giving money to banks when we could just be lending straight from the Fed to the federal government, I suppose. But right. It doesn't make any sense. You're right.
And when we talk about those leverage, when that type of leverage, this again was one of the sort of the, I guess, one of the things that people were really crying for was just there's a way to sort of control these too big to fail banks from leveraging the capital they have at whatever 30-to-1 ratios, and that is to say,
right,
you can only do it 12-to-1, and the
right.
The amazing thing is. Sandy Whale, yeah, I guess yesterday.
Yeah. Whale, yeah.
Comes out yesterday, or was it 2 days ago, and says, "Yeah, that's what we should do. We should do."
I know.
And I know.
I thought I was having an acid flashback when I saw that. I really did. Sandy Whale, he basically created Too Big to Fail by. You know, creating the Citigroup merger back in the 90s, which if people don't remember, he actually did this before it was legal. They did the Citi merger before Glass-Steagall had been repealed. Glass-Steagall prevented the merger of insurance companies, investment banks, and commercial banks, and they went ahead and they took Citigroup and Travelers and Solomon Smith Barney and merged them anyway, and then got an act of Congress to ratify it sort of retroactively, and now he's turning around and saying it's bad for America and we should break up the Too Big to Fail Bank.
What did people at your dinner last night have to say about that? I mean, people are just saying, he's
people
an old
were
coot.
Just,
no one's listened to him anymore. I mean, what did they say?
Oh, you know, people were rolling with laughter over the whole thing. In fact, I actually, a couple of people were pulling out their iPhones and just queuing it up and watching it over and over again for comic value. Because the funniest thing about that clip, if you watch it, he's being interviewed by CNBC, and he's saying this whole thing about how we have to break up the Too Big to Fail banks. It's bad for everybody, and the, you know, even on CNBC, the interviewer is like, "Oh, really? Didn't you create Too Big to Fail?" And he's totally surprised by that question, like he hadn't even anticipated it, and he basically says that. He didn't have any responsibility for that. That the barriers between commercial banking and investment banking have been broken long before he did that merger, and so it wasn't his problem. And so that's the funnier part of the
right. That he's so deluded. I mean, I read somewhere that in his memoir he said it should be the what was it the Graham Leach was that what, the Graham,
yeah, Graham
Leach,
Graham Leach Wiley,
well,
yeah.
Well,
yeah.
And I mean, I guess, you know, I've talked to people who say that Glass-Steagall was sort of the last linchpin of that, and that it had been slowly compromised over the years
right.
before then. But that's pretty – it's pretty stunning just sort of how divorced from that reality. There was a comic in Boston 20 years ago who had a joke to the effect of, like, he was telling some story about the Rolling Stones where Keith Richards, you know, had to tell some of his Rolling Stone buddies to calm down. And the punchline was, when Keith Richards tells you to back off, you know you got a problem.
Yeah,
and that's the only
exactly.
thing I could think of when I saw that that he had come out and said that. I mean, and he's right. We do have a tremendous problem. But I want to talk about, because I saw that you you wrote about Octopus, and mm-hmm. I'm a friend of Guy's, and he'd been telling me the story that he was writing. Guy was on the program a couple of weeks ago, a couple of Fridays mm-hmm. ago, talking about the book. And actually, while I was interviewing him, Sam Israel emailed him, having seen him on CBS that morning from prison. And it was like, dude, you were great. And you started off, it was funny because you started your post about it saying that Octopus is going to be made into a movie. And that was the first thing I said to Guy. I said, like, how can I insert myself between you and Hollywood right now so that I can make a killing off of this? Because this thing is, it really is an amazing story. And it's funny because I think there are basically two parts to this book, maybe one-third, two-thirds. One-third mm-hmm. is sort of teeing up Sam Israel as he sort of learns about Wall Street. And then maybe the second half of the book is how he gets sort of enmeshed in this incredible, I don't know if it was all a con or the con man was being conned himself. And it was like thrice over. And you really, I love that the part about the con, just because I spent so much time responding to Nigerian 419, email scams. And that's what this whole thing was, in just some type of massive scale. But
exactly,
you had a great point about the first part of the book. Talk about that, because you hit the nail on the head as to why Sam Israel fell for this greater con.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, the story is really, it's like a three-act play, right? Because he works on Wall Street and he learns how it all works. Then he decides that he wants to become big time himself, and he kind of almost accidentally becomes Bernie Madoff, because he starts a hedge fund and he experiences huge losses, and he decides to lie about them. And that leads to him sort of creating a Ponzi scheme where he's continually inventing returns that don't really exist, and that attracts more customers. And before you know it, he's got a $400 million hedge fund, but he's like incredibly underwater, and it's all going to blow up eventually. But then the last part of it is so he's one of the biggest con men on Wall Street and most successful. But then he himself gets sucked into this world where a bunch of conspiracy theorists convince him that there's this secret bond market for the Rothschilds and the Bilderbergs or whoever,
yes.
Who are, you know, trading at 50% coupon bonds or something like that, where they're making basically free money hand over fist. And
but they also, with those profits, they also very scrupulously divert like a certain percentage of those profits to like end world hunger and
cure AIDS and stuff.
Yes.
Yeah, I know, it's insane. It's crazy. But what's so hilarious about it is the reason that Israel falls for this is because he grew up on Wall Street and he saw that basically all of Wall Street is one giant insider trading and front-running factory. Every he was working for was gaming the system in one way or another. And I think the thing that really turned his psyche was when the crash in '87 happened and Wall Street should have been wiped out, and instead the Fed jumped in and basically backstopped all of Wall Street and allowed everybody to kind of borrow their way out of their problems. And he in his mind, what he created was this situation where you have a whole group of criminals on the one hand who are just routinely on a day-to-day basis stealing through insider trading, and it's all enabled by the federal government. And so why wouldn't there be a secret cabal of conspirators who are, you know, dealing in a secret bond market? And that's what's so fascinating. Is he wouldn't have believed in this story if he hadn't seen a lot of evidence that made it plausible, you know. And that's I love that part of it.
That part is just stunning. And then sort of there's another sort of concurrent it's not quite a scam, but it really does speak to, and I was reading that book at the same time I was reading Hayes's book on the Twilight of the Elites, which is talking about mm-hmm. how the elites are corrupting themselves. And while you've got this going on, there's a sort of a third player in this, which is John Ellis, George Bush's cousin, who
right,
he's got
yeah.
his own VC company, and he's looking, or he's these startups, and he's basically leached on to Sam Israel, who is living in a Donald Trump house, like a $25,000 a month house. And he's leached on to this guy because Israel is like a huge teat, sort of feeding money into his VC thing. And he actually carries messages from Sam Israel, more or less, to the White House.
Yeah, I know.
Beholden to that guy's money. He doesn't want to say at one point, like, you're completely bat crap crazy. it's just such a scary sort of view into what is actually going on in these corners. And I don't know that it was really that much of an anomaly.
No, but that's what's so amazing about the whole thing is that everywhere he looked, he just saw people acting in a predatory manner, and he saw that anybody who had any kind of information was trading against it instantaneously. And when he saw the behavior of the too big to fail banks, you know, in the crisis, years, and also in the internet stock bubble years, he knew that these big companies, the Goldmans and the Morgan Stanleys, that they were essentially gigantic insider trading, front-running operations, just like he would have been in that situation. And it's spelled out in such an obvious way in the book that the whole place is corrupt. That's the part that I think would be really shocking for most people. I mean, the story itself with that crazy plot twist is so unbelievable. It's incredible, and it'll be really entertaining for people. But that part of it is to me the amazing part.
Right. I mean, I remember it was sometime after maybe it was in 2002. I had gone to I was at a wedding, and someone I knew had married into a family with just a tremendous amount of wealth. And so, being completely without any sort of financial savvy whatsoever, I had an apartment at that time from my sitcom days. And I was like, talking to people, I was saying, if there's somebody goes into Macy's, at that time it was, certainly people were considering, somebody goes into Macy's and blows themselves up, won't every apartment in New York be worthless? And all these people said to me, that's kidding. The federal government would never let all that wealth disappear. And I was like, I don't even understand what you're talking about.
right.
It was just an understanding that the wealthy losing their wealth is completely backstopped by the government, whereas the poor being completely ravaged. I sat on a panel with Chris Hedges last night. We were talking about his book where he goes into these sort of what he calls sacrifice zones, four of the most sort of destitute places in the country, one of them being Camden, New Jersey, not far from where you are now. And it's just those places have just been completely obliterated. And there's no one coming to their rescue, of course. And I don't know. I found the whole thing just sort of stunning. When you sit down with these Wall Street types, what is their sense about that the whole thing is rigged? I mean, we saw a story that came out, I think, a couple of days after the Octopus came out about front running that was happening with hedge funds getting sort of a wink and a nod from institutional analysts as to whether or not they're going to revise their analyst reports up or down. It was all sort of like, hey, any surprises that we should be, don't tell me anything, specific, but any surprises, cough once for up, cough twice for down. And
right, exactly. Hang up if it's good. Don't stand in the line if it's bad. Yeah. No, I think most people on Wall Street have no illusions about the system. I think on a macro level, people think that there still are some real bets you can make. You know, should you buy gold? Should you buy treasury? Should you do this or that? But certainly, you know, stocks and equities and even interest rate changes in the Fed. If you'll notice, there's always like a flurry of activity just before interest rate changes are announced, you know, because the word is getting out somehow, and so people are trading against that. I've had people call me who work for little brokerages, and they say that, a big bank will call them at the end of a trading day and say, we want to buy soybeans or wheat or corn or whatever. And so they'll place the order for the bank. And then 2 minutes later, $1 billion will go on the market because that same bank just executed a trade order for, a pension fund in California or whatever it is. So they're front running their own clients. So this stuff is rampant. I think everybody knows that. It's completely dirty. And the regulators are so totally overmatched with this stuff. There just aren't enough of them, and the schemes are just too clever for them to catch. So it's crazy.
So is there a solution to this, or is it simply like, this is just a linchpin of society? At its heart, our financial system is, all just sort of an illusion. But if enough people just sort of play along with it, that's the way it functions. I mean, is that sort of like the LIBOR scandal?
Yeah, I guess.
I mean, is that do they all? Everybody just says, like, look, this is the way that humans interact with each other. You know, when two people sit down at a table, they look across. It's just basically two projections of reality that are meeting each other that don't necessarily have anything to do with the realities that are actually sitting there.
Yeah, no, I think that's the argument that you get from a lot of these companies whenever they're accused of wrongdoing. You hear the term sophisticated investors a lot, which is it's basically a code for the people that we deal with know that we're out to screw them, when we do screw them, we shouldn't be accused of any wrongdoing, because everybody in this world has their eyes wide open, and we all know that we're all trying to stab each other in the back. And that's kind of the attitude on Wall Street now, is that, with Goldman, for example, when Goldman was privately trashing its, mortgage-backed derivatives in 2009, that they were trying to unload on everybody, and then they were turning around and, writing sales booklets saying how great they were. When they got caught for that, they were like, hey, what do you expect? We're all grown-ups here, what do you think we're trying to do here, not make money? And that's kind of the attitude. I think it's not going to stop until this is not something you can regulate away. It just you have to just change the attitudes of people so that it's just no longer honorable to do that. But I just don't see that happening.
I mean, that's, I guess, got to come more culturally, right? I mean,
right, yeah, exactly. I mean, why don't you mug an old lady? You just don't. I mean, it's not because it's against the law or you're going to get caught. You just don't do it, and that's what's got to happen with these people. They got to reach that point.
Interesting. And lastly, I know you commented on Friedman's piece yesterday, which was sort of really a tour de force. Yeah, I was going to say for Friedman, because that was. And I don't know if you've listened to that that podcast that Glenn Greenwald seemed to have found it from an interview that he did in March in New Zealand, and it's really I would check it out. He's got to post it at Solana. It really is unbelievable, because first off, you've got this New Zealand woman who sounds like she's in her 70s, and she's. Or maybe 60s. I mean, she's just an older woman, very sort of like benign sounding, but she's dogging him. And Friedman is losing it. And by the end, he has to say, like, I don't know what neoliberal economics is. It's not a word that I use. And she says, why not? Everybody else does. And he's actually at the point where he is trying to, she sort of like boxes him in over the course of a 35 minute, 40 minute interview. And within the last like 10 minutes, she sort of closes in the walls. He feels it coming the whole time. So he's incredibly paranoid as to where she's leading him. And he's at one point saying like, well, if we have to raise the retirement age for Social Security from 62 to 62 and a half, I don't see the big deal in that. And so you realize, like, you know, here's this guy. He is lying, knowingly lying to this New Zealand, you know, radio host. I mean, there must be, you know, her listenership, how many thousands of people could there be, you know, that are listening to her?
Right.
And he is knowingly lying about what the retirement age is so that he can sort of get off the phone. And it's and then she asks about his wealth and he gets all huffy. It was really fantastic just to hear, because first off, I don't know anywhere in American media where you would have Friedman on the phone for 45 minutes.
Having to defend himself.
And then aside from that, anybody who ever could get him on the phone for 45 minutes would never challenge him because,
right.
He won't come back and then a whole raft of other people won't come back. This woman
right.
was just like, I'm never going to talk to Thomas Friedman again.
Right.
I'm going to, you know, this is, I don't care. I'm in New Zealand, a-hole. And it's a beautiful.
You know what? I've kind of come around on Thomas Friedman. I used to think he was like the Prince of Darkness, and this was back in his whole Iraq cheerleading
right.
stuck on this days. But now I think he's kind of mellowed and, to me, he's just funny. I think he seems to be a guy who's just making an enormous amount of money, being essentially a buffoon, and kind of enjoying himself. And he's got that mustache and everything, and he's got that huge. It just seems like a really fun life. I mean, I think he actually probably gets a kick out of writing these columns that he must know just make no sense at all, and collecting enormous amounts of money for doing it. That just seems like a fun life to me. I don't know. I mean,
it's helped by the fact that he's married to a billionaire heiress.
Right, that's true. Yeah,
and so I think it's more about for him. I think he's just not nearly as bright as he is given credit for. I think he's just a bumbling fool who, for him, I get there's a lot more white knuckled sort of quality to Thomas Friedman that I have always picked up from this guy, that he is sort of constantly riding this wave of being afraid of being exposed, knowing on some level that if he loses his gig as a New York Times op-ed columnist and sort of this chief opiner of the establishment class, that his wife may just go like, you're kind of chubby, and throw him overboard.
I totally agree with you, and I think that fear is what drove him to be the meanie that he was back in the early Bush years. But
yeah.
Now I think he's kind of reached this like late stage nirvana where he realizes that he's already been exposed and nobody cares, and he still gets to get all the money and gets to, and so he's happy.
Listen to this interview, because he is so defensive.
Okay.
It really is awesome. And
I'll
I will say this. I had one of the highlights of my personal punditry career was sitting. I did Dylan Radigan's show with him, and I didn't know, I knew that day that he was going to be on. And I worked in the phrase into a question to him sitting across the table, suck on this. And the look on his face for the rest of the show as he was just sort of glaring at me, looking to see if I did that on purpose, was one of just the favorite moments I've had, I think, perhaps in the past 10 years. I think he's a pretty angry guy down below, because I think he's always afraid of being exposed, but I've heard that he's just gone off on people, like just like full on swearing tirade. And
Well, that's kind of funny too. I wouldn't mind being a person like that too. So I don't know. I'm trying to appreciate him. I'm trying to not. I don't know. I'm getting older, I guess. I'm not as.
You're losing your edge, buddy.
I know, man. I know. I'm becoming a bourgeois. But
there you go.
Anyway.
All right. Well, and nevertheless, still a pleasure to talk to you.
Absolutely, Sam.
Thanks.
Let's get to begin soon.
Yes. All right. Matt Taibbi, folks, RollingStone.com. Thank you so much.
And all right. Take care.
Bye-bye. And, of course, his books are available on, Audible.com as audiobooks. What is it? Majority Report? I don't know what that thing is. Mike, we got it up there. What is the name of it? I know what the name of the show
audiblepodcast.com/majority report.
audiblepodcast.com/majority report.
You have to put in audiblepodcast.com/majority report, not audible.com. audiblepodcast.com/majority report.
And then they know that we have sent you there. And then hopefully they'll keep, sending us the big bucks for those advertising things. But Matt Taibbi. All right, folks. Whoa. We're going to head into the better half of the program, ladies and gentlemen. And let me take this moment to say that while I appreciate the support of company like Audible.com, they don't quite pay the bills here. And this morning, we had one of those days where the internet was down for like 5 minutes, and I was just like, oh, God, we got to get higher bandwidth. We've got to get a second line in here, but I don't want to pay the whatever it is, $700 annually extra that it would cost. Folks, it is your memberships that support this program, whether you listen to the first half, whether you listen to both halves, whether you get DVD swag, whatever it is your support that keeps the program alive. As a bonus to people who support the program as members, give you an extra 50 minutes a day, give you DVDs, but that's a bonus. That's called gravy. But if you're eating the meat and the potatoes, or despite what the USDA says, a meatless Monday and real potatoes, we need your support. You can become a member at majority.fm. And let me just throw in this tip as well. Radishes. I know they've gotten a very bad rap, particularly from kids, because you eat them raw. Try throwing them in an iron skillet with a little bit of olive oil and frying those babies up. Brown them. You're going to enjoy it. See what you get? You can also support this program by buying your Amazon crap through our Amazon link at majority.fm/support-the-show. You'll find the Amazon link there. Click it, bookmark it, buy all your Amazon crap through it. We get a kickback. JustCoffee.coop. Fair trade. Fair trade. Everybody gets paid a fair wage. And it's co-op. So it's an employee-owned company. Coupon code MAJORITY gets a 10% discount. You can buy the Majority FM blend. People love it, except for Mark Maron, apparently, shooting off unsolicited mean tweets about it. You can show Mark Maron a thing or two by buying the Majority.fm blend, getting a 10% discount, getting great coffee, supporting a great company. I don't know. That's like a win-win-win-win-win-win. And, of course, your reviews on iTunes help, I was going to say immeasurably, but actually, no. Specifically, you can measure it. And so every time you give a review on iTunes, you can actually measure that. It adds a review and brings more people to the show. Post our YouTubes around. Tell people about the program. When we head into the better half, we will talk about the fact that Medicaid saves lives, ladies and gentlemen, according to a new study by Harvard researchers. And also a case that with our incredibly low borrowing rates for the U.S. government, we should be spending money on building roads that are buckling because of the heat, etc., etc. See you in the better half, 646-257-3920 if you want to call. You can IM me at Majority FM or on any IM device by looking up the name Majority FM at jabber.org. So any of your IM protocols or clients should work. See you in a bit.